And welcome to, or welcome back to the On Coaching Podcast. I'm Steve Magnus, joined as always by my good friend and colleague, John Marcus. John, what's going on, my man?
Steve, you already know, it is that time. Time to give the people what they want.
That is right. And we've got a hot topic today. But before we get to that, we need to tell you about two things real quick. First, if after our last episode, you haven't ordered my new book, Do Hard Things, I don't know what you're doing. You got to get on board. And plus, it's 30%+ off on Amazon. So, you know, again, we're about deals here.
For all the 19 deals. Bucks, all the deals.
19 bucks, you get 320 pages, years of research, writing, coaching, wisdom. And you know what else is a great deal, John? For less than a dollar a day, you can join the Scholar Program, get all sorts of courses. You can jump in and be a part of the clubhouse, which is officially popping as we have discussion groups on just about everything.
Yeah, it's great.
Like, if there's a coaching topic that's covered, we got people discussing it. So jump on in, you know, come in with, we're at just about 300 people in that discussion group.
Yeah, it's wild. Is phenomenal. Like every day, like there's, you know, amazing people, amazing scholars, amazing coaches, amazing athletes. I mean, we got people who are diving deep on fascial tissue health, you know, a lot of robust discussion about mental literacy and fitness, you know, going on. Also, just pure X's and O's, coaching high school, coaching post-collegiates, you know, workouts, workout orders, progression, periodization. And of course, right now, we are in the midst of the mini course live, The Perfect Stride. This is my labor of love. Talking about being a reactive runner, meaning you're using reflexes and more of that reactive mechanisms of the body, than being what we call a non-reactive runner, who is kind of quote-unquote muscling it every step of the way. And it's really interesting because, like, this has taken me years to discover and figure out, but we have these special abilities that Mother Nature infused us with, and now we just have to unlock them. And I've given away all the secrets so you can unlock it to have a more reactive stride, run faster, with less effort, higher economy, and quicker recovery. It's everything that the Super Shoes promised to be, but yet endowed by Mother Nature.
All right. So get on board. If you haven't, check that out. Actually, John, before we get into this week's podcast, I just want to give a special shout out. I love our listeners, but last week I was at Vern Gambetta's amazing Gain conference, which if you haven't ever gone to that, you need to.
John, it's worth it. Yep. Totally worth it.
Yep. So check it out. But I got to listen to high school coach extraordinaire Scott Christensen of Stillwater, Minnesota, who's coached some fabulous champions on the high school level. But more importantly, I think many who have gone on, like Ben Blankenship, to do amazing things on the professional level. And we got to chat briefly, and he said, Steve, you know what? I listen to you and John when I'm cooking dinner. I listen, love the podcast. So Scott, shout out to Scott. We love when great coaches who are doing real things in the real world and making a difference are listening. And
golly, that is huge. Yes. I mean, you know, also hats off to Scott. He has been one of the long stewards of coaching education in America, always bringing really novel and insightful concepts, really unpacking physiology. When I was a young coach starting off, you know, a lot of his articles and content I looked to kind of orient me about, you know, how to, you know, think about the training process in more of a metabolic physiological reaction and recovery standpoint. So, you know, he's been doing it a long time. So the fact that he gave that kudos is huge. So thank you. That's phenomenal.
Exactly. So, all right, let's get into this week's podcast. Fast losers.
Seems to be a lot of them around nowadays. Oh, boy.
Oh, man. John's going to get us in trouble here. But what we're really talking about here is a phenomenon that has grown both, I think, at the high school all the way to the college and the professional realm, which is we have a lot of people who are good at running fast, time trial, but we often neglect the other component, which is racing, the skills of racing tactically. And this is so vital. And I think it's something that, okay, why are we losing out on this a little bit? Well, a couple of reasons. I think if you go all the way down to the high school realm, often what you're seeing now and now is more is set up races, right? Back in my day, I'm going to sound old now, but back in 2003, when I was running fast, you know the only race that had a rabbit in it that I ran?
Which one, Steve?
The pre-classic, and it certainly wasn't a rabbit for me.
Yep.
I wasn't going out in whatever, 154 with Bernard Lagat. But that's the only race that I ran, quote-unquote, with a rabbit. It's the only race, every other race that I ran and competed in, ran 401 for 1600, 403, all those good things, was me. And it wasn't just always, you know, I led a lot, but it was also me competing against in the same area. I had Eric Stanley, who ran 403. I had Brian Sullivan, who was like an 849, 3200 guy and 40 something. A lot of other, you know, Kyle Miller, who was a 150 and, you know, 40 guy. And then, of course, during that same era, Leo Manzano, who was a 40 guy at that point. And, not all the time, but well, especially Brian and Eric, we would race each other a lot because we lived like 10 minutes away from each other and went to three different schools. But there was just racing, right? And it wasn't as much of, okay, let's just go set this up in time trial. And then I think, okay, great. Well, look at college. And I'm not trying to reminisce again, but college, what was it? Yes, you had a standard to make the regional meet, but back then you could actually make the regional meet if you were a conference champion. Mm-hmm. Remember that rule?
I do. Yeah, I remember it.
You could race your way to regionals. And then the nice thing was regional standard was relatively soft back then. And it was split up not just two regions. There were, I don't remember, six, seven, something like that. A lot more regions. So you had a lot more people relatively qualify. And then you raced your way to nationals. And I think now, like, again, the regional standard or the standard to get in the first round has gotten so difficult that you have to travel to the setup races in order to get the standard, which is tough because, again, I remember back in our day, like, you know, I had friends who got the standard at, you know, Rice University, Know Nothing track, where we just run fast and check our standard off. And then we'd be like, all right, we're at regional. So we'll worry about racing there and conference and all that stuff. And then you go to the professional side. And I think the other thing that is really interesting on this, then I'll turn it over to you, John, but just setting the stage historically, is we've had an increased abundance of athletes going straight from high school to pro. Right. And then even more so, we've had an abundance of people leaving colleges early. So they go 1 or 2 years, kind of like the NBA, and then get thrust into the crucible of professional racing. And then on the professional side, the standards have gotten even tougher in a lot of events. So again, what is it? Set up the race, get in the fast race, get your time. And then thanks to the pandemic as well, I think we saw an overabundance of, okay, some of these traditional races are gone. Let's set up these time, a lot more time trials. And while we're running really fast, sometimes we forget the crucible that is racing, which mm-hmm. is what happens at the championships, both US nationals, NCAAs, but also, you know, worlds.
Right. And that's, I think it's a lot of it's just, you know, media throwing out a lot of like, you know, sensationalism and junk and garbage to catch your eyeballs, headlines and attention, right? And we have more fast people than ever before because of super shoes, etc., right? You know, up to this recording, 5 high school boys have broken 4 in the mile this year alone, which is absurd. It's definitely not the standard it once was of difficulty with, you know, you know, all due respect to the high school kids and coaches who are running those marks. So we have to recalibrate, right? And the thing is like, I think people, you know, have a misinterpretation about what's the point of training and competing in, say, distance and middle distance races. Is there's a big relational component, and the relational component to the meet and heat you're in, the people you're around, and that subtlety is really important. Because even when I was a meet director and setting up these initial first wave of these, you know, high performance, you know, time trial meets that are now ubiquitous, I took sensitivity in the fact like certain types of people, you know, would bring certain qualities to a competition or a race that others might not, right? And so you had people who quote unquote had to make the race, right? And there were, you know, in the 2010s, a certain number of people, like David Torrance, you know, rest in peace, was one of those people who would make the race. And people don't understand, like, when the pacer drops out after halfway or two thirds of the way, because everyone wants the pacer to go as far as possible. But the reality is, the people who would make the race typically would always be people who would be competitive in championship or non-time trial settings as well, and knew how to race in there. And so we see these start lists of all these people and athletes sometimes who, you know, get into these setup races. But then you have to really look closely and go, is anyone in here capable of making the race? Because everyone's capable of hanging on and driving. And yeah, there might be this time or that time, but it doesn't matter. Like even, let's say, Portland Track Festival, right? I remember when Brenda Martinez was coming in and, you know, at the time she was like, I want to just run really fast in the 15, right? And she's like, I don't want to do it at pre. I don't want to do it with all this. I just want to do it here. You know, let's get 2-3 rabbits. Let's really go for it. Let's make the race. And she did. And other people went with her, but she was the one who took that impetus. Okay, I'm making the race. And she ran 4:02 at the time without super shoes. Or when Evan Jaeger and, Garrett Heath went back and forth in that epic, at the time, it might even still be, but at the time, you know, U.S. soil 1500 meter record. Well, that was set up because, you know, Danny Mackey was like, hey, we want to get Garrett to turn really, really fast in the 15. We want to do it here. Okay, we got two rabbits here. But then Evan hopped in with him. And because Garrett was going for it and Evan was also in there at the same time, two of those guys battling back and forth made the race, so both ran real fast in the 15. Had it just been a situation where it was only, you know, Garrett or only Evan, might not have panned out that way. So that relational component is really important. And when you're coaching people, even to run fast, you got to, you know, coach them, I think, to be able to make the race and figure out how to make the race on their own. And you can use these time trial races for that. But if your philosophy is just, we're going to get you really fit, and we're going to just, you know, so you can just hang on and suck on and whatever to get the mark. Yeah, in the short term, it gets them to the next round or gets them the mark or what have you, but it doesn't necessarily prepare them for the crucible that is competitive championship style running. And you are seeing this, like the Hob Kesslers of the world aren't qualifying out of the rounds, right? The Drew Hunters are having, you know, rocky road. You know, the Cole Hawkers are, you know, not qualifying out of the rounds. Like, it's like, everyone's like, what's wrong with them? They got, you know, they bombed. It's like, no, it's just really, really hard. You got to remember, like, the U.S. Outdoor Championship meet is the second hardest track and field meet in the world every year outside the Olympic Games or the World Championships. So to say, oh, this person who ran one fast time somewhere is bombed because they couldn't make it out of a round to a final, or couldn't make it from the final to the podium, you know, it's a gross misinterpretation and simplification of what's actually happening.
Yeah, exactly. I think, again, and we're not trying to call anybody out, but it's just use examples of late. because I think it's interesting, and we've seen this again throughout history, but, and it can be overcome, you know, the thing early in his career, Donovan Brazier was always seen as this, right? And then he won a world championship and figured it out.
But the timeline is different when you go out. Like, and that's the thing. That's the good thing about college racing is because there's so much racing and you have to go through conference and you have to go through regionals and then you have to go through nationals, you get a lot more exposure and opportunity. But when you leave early or go out or don't go at all, when and where are you going to get that learning?
Yeah, and I think it's important here because what often happens is tactics are easy when you're superior.
Head and shoulders, like, yes. Yeah.
When you're superior, when you're head and shoulders, it's not a big deal. Like, tactics are easy. Even when you're in the pack, you know, it's easy because you have the confidence that you're okay. You know, I always remember when I was coaching collegiately at the conference meet, we had this really good girl or this woman from Temple. Wichita, who was a great steepler, Rebecca Topham. And she'd run like all these events in conference. And she'd just hang out in the back. Why? Because she was like an Olympic trials qualifying, you know, steepler. So when she'd run the steeple or the 5K at conference, like she was better than pretty much everybody else by a significant margin. So she could just hang out, you know, and it wasn't pressed if like 8-9 people were ahead of her or what have you. She knew even though she was in like 9th place, she was in control. At any moment, she could move and be okay. When you move up and everyone's good, or I shouldn't say good, I should say everyone's on relatively equal footing and the margins are slimmer, you lose that sense of, oh, I'm in control, right? So even Cole Hawker, if you watched his prelim, he led most, you know, basically the entire thing until the last lap, you know, but everyone's good. So it's not like he's in control. He can do that in the college setting and be like, oh, once I turn on the jets, everyone's gone. On the US side, it doesn't have that. And often, you know, people can turn on the jets too. Often what happens is, again, you're running along and you feel a little pressed or pressure because people are still there. You're not dropping people. You're still, you know, maybe you get passed or what have you. And it's our brain's instinctual reaction to essentially be like, oh God, what's happening? Like freak out, right? And then you lose control and you spiral. And that is something, well, how do you learn that? You got to go through the crucible of being put through rounds, put through competitive environments where you're dealing with that uncertainty, navigating it from a psychological standpoint and figuring it out. And then the other part that I'd say, I mean, that's from a psychological standpoint, but there's also from what I'd call as a tactical efficiency standpoint. So stupid moves when you're in high school and college, you can make up for them if you're better than everybody else. Right? Doesn't matter. You'll recover from it. Stupid moves or bad spots at a higher level are much more difficult. And we actually saw this in the NCAA this year by someone who I think is a great tactician, Mario Garcia Romo. Great tactician. Always looks in control, you know, handling the race. But for whatever reason, NCAA 1500 championship, he made a couple tactical errors and found himself boxed and didn't get free and then lost a race to an unheralded Washington athlete who both on paper, on PRs, is not Garcia Romo's equal, but ended up winning the race because he was tactically more efficient. And the margin for error, especially in tactical races, is so slim. And that's what happens. You're off by just a little bit, or you waste too much energy here or there, and then you're a couple tenths slower, which doesn't matter normally. But here, when everyone's battling, it puts you between, hey, I qualified, and hey, I'm on the outside looking in.
Yeah, it's the ability to race people and not the clock is really important. And it's easy to lose sight of that. And it's easy to say, oh, well, you know, I coach this athlete who's so superior in their conference or on the team. They have no one to train with. And that's not true, right? You know, they have people to train with. And if you are trying to coach people to relate, be more relational and race people, you can set up different practices and strategies where it's like, all right, you know, this athlete's running 300 meters very, very fast, but then at 150, these other athletes come in, or, you know, an older athlete who's a little bit better, or, you know, you're coaching women, you can use men, you can use them as tethers to create that situation where they are challenged in the moment and they have to figure out a solution. Because that's really what's going on. It's like the time trial settings, they are not challenging where we need a solution. It's just keep the pace, keep the pace, keep the pace. And it's a, you know, a game of form and a game of ability and who can redline the longest, right, before they acquiesce to fatigue, versus, you know, fast losers. While on paper, it looks very attractive. And we're seeing this more because of the super shoe effect, right? I mean, you can't go into anything and say the person who has the fastest or one of the fastest times before the championship meet is going to make the final, is going to make the podium. You know, case in point with the NCAA men's 15 this year. It's not that direct of a, you know, transfer anymore. So then what we have to do is figure out a situation or a reality where it's like, what are the skill sets and abilities someone needs to be able to be competitive, both when everyone is relatively fresh, when the bell lap happens or the kick starts to happen, and then two, when everyone's relatively fatiguing when that happens, right? Because those are different skill sets and that speed or strength in different contexts. And then the other thing that people forget too is if your reality, if you're one of those people who, you know, your focal point is, oh, we only go to fast meets where it's all set up and there's a high level of arousal and we're going to go to this big time meet or this big time meet or this invite meet or this, you know, blah, blah, blah. Well, then you get to like say a round or something and the arousal level is not that high for that athlete because they're so used to this. And you look at this, they look at the start list and they go, oh yeah, it should be easy. I'll just walk my way into the next round or the final. When the reality is it's not the case at all, because for a lot of the other athletes, when there is a more level playing field, when there are tactics involved, when everyone's not fatigued at the end and has kind of a similar bandwidth of speed or strength, well, for that, you know, quote unquote, more marginal athlete or modest athlete with the time on paper, well, they're going to be more aroused in that setting because they're excited. They're like, oh, I get a shot. Oh man, okay, I'm trying to make the final, I'm being scrappy. And then, you know, that's why you see all the time, especially in the 15s. I love watching 15 rounds because it's just all the time this happens. It's very frequent that someone who takes their big swing nails a home run and makes the final, makes the podium, you know, wins the championship, et cetera. And that's the beauty of it, is their arousal level might be a lot higher than now that person who's conditioned to only being in that really highly aroused time trial-esque setting all the time.
Yeah, I think that's a very important vital thing. And I think it goes even a step further in that those maybe guys or gals who are just below, it's like they also gain this like mental psychological momentum throughout often the championship races. Because in the time trials, you know, if you're Cole Hawker running 331 and you go up against a 337 guy, you're going to go through halfway realistically, you know, a couple seconds ahead of that 337 guy, you know? And the 337 guy's mindset is just like, oh my gosh, I'm just hanging on. I can't even see Cole Hawker. Like, I'm not even paying attention to him because he's up there. When you're in the championship race, it's often, again, a little bit more tactical, a little bit slower at first. You keep that athlete in there. And for some athletes, they can almost, it's like they can smell the finish line. And, you know, they can summon something else out of them because it's like, oh, I'm in this. I've got a shot. I'm sixth or seventh and top five or top four or whatever go on. Like, they're right there. And you can almost sometimes will yourself to do crazy things because it's like the goal is there. The meaning is there. That thing that means a ton to you is right there. And often, again, what happens is when you're a favorite or you're somebody who whatever have you, is you're just kind of like, okay, I'm going through the motions, get this done. And this is often seen, you know, I think this is a great example too in the 100, which you'd be like, tactical, what? But look at Sha'Carri Richardson, 11.3 after running, you know, 10.8, 10.9 a couple weeks ago. How does that happen? And you see it every once in a while with others. It's like, well, all those other sprinters are jazzed because they know, oh, I got to be ready for this one. This is my final. And, you know, she probably, I don't know, she didn't talk to the media, but part of it is probably like, yes, nerves, anxiety of it. But it's also probably like, oh, first round, like, I got this, you know? And she's, again, one who came out of college, went on fire, obviously did a, you know, performed well at the Olympic trials, but then has had chaos since and hasn't honestly dealt with it maybe the best in terms of her performance, it seems like. And this is why, again, it's like, would she have benefited from going through the crucible of rounds in an NCAA championship or like spending more time with, you know, learning how to do that? Maybe. I mean, it's not for me to say. She also probably got paid a lot, so mm-hmm. I'm not saying yeah. It's the wrong decision. It's probably the right decision there. But, you know, it's interesting because I think a lot of times we have to think of, okay, how do we prepare people for, again, championship-style racing when it counts?
Yeah, it's tough because you also want this concept of conserving your energy, right? So you want to be able to advance, but advance if you are kind of one of the more the heavy favorites or the people who has a mark or form above head and shoulders above other people, you want to advance with the least amount of effort and energy possible. But I always respected, you know, what Evan Jaeger said a long time ago. It's like, yeah, the US trials or Olympic trials, you know, it's basically every race is the final and you have to treat it like that. You have to, because it's just about position. Like, they're not going to just let someone through because they have a better PR or faster marks going into that race, even though they got, you know, a low place, right? So that mindset's important, and it's more or less of a mindset of, I want this, I need this, I got to get this striving mindset versus, in some ways, you have to have a defensive mindset of like, you know, I have to defend my territory. I have to, you know, make sure like I don't not make it, like, and do whatever I need to do to ensure that reality happens, right? Because so often we go into these type of, or athletes can go into these types of settings in a, you know, rounds or championship style competition, and think to themselves like, oh, I want it, I, you know, and I want to go for it. But then, you know, when you're met with the hard reality of like, how much do I like will myself to make it through to this next round? I thought this was supposed to be easy. I thought this was cakewalk. I was told like, oh, conserve your energy. Well, then that, again, the arousal's not there because now you're met with this challenge that your camp and yourself was unprepared for. And in the moment, in the split second it takes, you know, striving to the finish line there in the last 50 meters, 25 meters, whatever, if you're not having that emotional reservoir and capacity on deck and available, it's going to be very difficult because your mindset's going to be a oh shit mindset and reeling mindset versus like a, oh, you know, better turn it on mindset because I was prepared that this might happen mindset.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of it is that framing, right? And I watch, you know, I watch Carl Lewis and Leroy Burrell do this very well often with the sprinters going into the NCAAs and other things, is like reminding them again and again and again, like, what are you trying to do? What are we doing out of this? Like, what is the mindset coming in? And for the sprints, it's a little different because, yeah, you might try and conserve a little bit. But what they'd often see is, you know, maybe our top guys would have, they'd have to do like the 100, the 200, the 4x1, sometimes the 4x4. So there's a lot going on. And the tendency is often like, oh, conserve, 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 just get through, get cute. And they would pre-race meetings, pre-whatever, they would combat that all the time. You know, it's like, it was almost like framing it as today is a final. We'll worry about tomorrow. You know, when we get tomorrow, we've got a plan for tomorrow. You just focus on today, final, etc. Because they had to survive in advance. And I think often in the distance running world, we get cute. And I've suffered from this, even in my coaching. I mean, I remember you were there when Brian Barraza barely
through. I was sitting next to you.
Yeah. And I'm like, what are you doing, dude? Yeah. Like, what are you doing? Like, he was, again, fit enough to do stuff, but he got cute. He got apathetic a little bit. And he's a hell of a competitor, but it was just like, oh, like, I'll be okay. And in the last couple meters got caught and had to come through on time when he was one of the favorites. So
because the
body, that's just our natural tendency.
Yeah, and if that's your mindset too, like, you're already making plans and that's really important from like Carl Leroy. Like, if you're already making plans in advance for tomorrow, you already think you have it, right? And so you automatically let up. You automatically don't allow yourself to, you know, expend that energy, because in your brain you're like, oh, I already have this. And we see that so often, right? With, you know, people who when we get kind of close to a goal or close to the end, right? And we kind of let up a little bit. Well, if you go into the situation thinking you already have it and making plans for tomorrow, the final, it's going to be really tough to, you know, release the energy and expend the energy to actually make that a reality.
Exactly. So much of this is framing. And I think the other part of this that is really important is that there's a teaching component, right? So, like, for example, with my college kids, we would watch races of NCAAs or rounds or conference rounds or what have you, to like simulate, to essentially, you know, break things apart, watching film like other sports would do. But on the other hand, is like, there is nothing like being in the race itself. So it's almost like this stress inoculation. No, we don't want to just throw people in the deep end and see if they can swim, but we want to like teach them, okay, here are the things that we have to do. Then we got to train them up, which happens in practice and then also in races. It's why I'm a big believer of, like, you know, for example, even someone at the lower level, I would try and take someone as maybe a freshman or a sophomore to the conference championship before they were ready to score, right? If we had the spots, I'd be like, ah, you know, I think they'll be able to next year. But if we got the spots, I'd love to take this athlete because I want them to get in this environment. I want them to go through rounds of the 800 or 1500 or mile or what have you, or double back from the 1500 to the 5K. I want them to get that experience so that we can understand, learn from it, and be prepared the next time. So even on the small level, you're often thinking, okay, how do I prepare athletes to go through these things? You know, and good athletes often, again, if it didn't matter too much, I would sometimes run them in off events if we were okay on the conference meet in conference championships. For example, one year I remember Brian ran the 1500. Why? Because I already knew he could run the 5K or the steeple or whatever had we at that event. But I wanted him to get used to going through rounds in an event that wasn't his specialty and then figure out how to again, run tactically and be pressed. Because there were a heck of a lot more guys in the 1500 who were equals to him or close to him than in the steeple in our conference meet. So again, sometimes you can prepare by putting people in situations that, you know, are much different or are different races than they're used to.
And it's also about giving people concrete action plans about what they can and can't do relationally to the field, right? You know, so often it's just like this time, it's like it's reminding athletes things you've worked on the whole season, or, you know, even from a year-to-year basis with them about where they're really strong and where they can't leave it to chance, right? So like with the high school kids that I worked with this year, I would remind them before their district or state race, like, look, relative to the field, and I've did the research, you know, now you can watch people run and look at videos and stuff that you might not have, your competitors that you might not have faced often or much throughout the year. And it's like, you have the best last 150 of anyone in the field. And you got to remind yourself why. Well, because we've done all the strength work, these wickets, these sprints, blah, blah, blah. You know, give them actual tangible examples of where they're really strong, or also what they can't do. Like, don't leave it to chance. Don't leave it to be this type of race, right? So we can use a really concrete example. Let's say, you know, this young lady I worked with this year was a double state champion in the 15 and 3K. Well, two different strategies, right? In the 3K, she was head and shoulders fitter than everyone else in the field, right? So that was an example of like, you know, I was asked, okay, well, what do you want to do? How do you want to play? Oh, I want to, you know, hang out and just do that. I go, no, you know what you need to do? You need to just go right from the gun and just run. Just run hard. That's it. Just run hard. Don't wait for 800, because you're head and shoulders fitter. And in that type of race, in a 3000, you know, sure, people will try to stick with you, but the sting will happen at about 6 minutes. And sure enough, that's what happened. And she just completely dominated and won that 3K by, you know, 100, 200 meters, something ridiculous, right? The time wasn't crazy fast. I mean, it was around her fastest time, you know, maybe a couple seconds for the year. But relative to the field, that was her best strategy to ensure that she'd win. The next day was the 15. Much different strategy in the 15. Like, we had to say, okay, you're a little fatigued from the 3K the day before. You're facing someone who's a 15.8 runner who, you know, has no races under their belt. So they're coming in fresh. So now, but what we have to do is ensure that you can use your ability to kick, because she had one of the best open fours in the field, but use it so you maximize your state of freshness. So much different race strategy. You do not lead for the first 800 no matter what. Then if you feel like it, sure, go ahead, you know, take initiative, because she was an aggressive, you know, competitive athlete. But always remember, you have to press, but always have something in your back pocket, and, you know, sprint when it's time to sprint. And when you sprint, give all into the sprint. And you probably want to sprint with about 120 to 100 meters to go, or 80 meters to go, coming off the turn, right? And we had very concrete rationale reasons for this. And the race played out very, very similar to what we had planned for. I mean, she let the competitor lead for the first bit. The pace was good, and then it slackened. Then she took over, and then they traded the lead back and forth several times in the last 500 meters. And coming off the turn, she was actually behind with 80 meters to go by about, you know, a couple strides. But she just trusted her kick and, like, you know, she just saw the wickets, just put the foot down, just, you know, just remembered what she remembered was her training all year long for her sprint with us. And she ended up catching and outleaning the competitor and winning the 15 by like 0.2, hundredths of a second. It's pretty epic. But I was not concerned, you know, in the least, because I just knew she knew how to sprint, and I knew she had enough in the tank, because the competitor had taken off with her final surge with about 220 to go. And I was like, it's probably a little too early for her. And it was just like one of those happy circumstances, and, you know, easily could have gone the other way. No questions asked. But it was really concrete on how to compete relative to her strengths and her abilities, relative to what we had been working on with her all year, relationally to the field. And, you know, that was just, it was fun to see, versus, like, say, this melee 100 meter runner that won state, complete inverse dialogue. Like, it was like, look, you're really competitive. These guys, you got some 4.8 guys who are just going to go out, like, let them go out. But when you go at 200, you have to go and hold. Like, you just have to hold it, because, like, you don't have in the eight, like there's no drive to the finish. It's a game of who decelerates the least, right? So it's like, just go and hold, like give it everything you got and then just hold on for dear life. And that's what happened, right? I mean, he just took off at two. He had about a good 120 meters. And then with 80 meters to go, I could see him like just kind of like glancing around side to side, looking at the Jumbotron, just like, I'm holding on for dear, but he held on for dear life and won. So again, and he didn't have the fastest time in the state going into the meet. Like, you know, he was in the top two or three or four, but it wasn't like he was the favorite. But we just played to his strengths and played to, you know, what he could control. And then also too, just understand there is an ingredient of hope and the unknown. And you have to be okay with that tension of not knowing if your plan is going to work, but executing it to the best of your ability. And then, you know, like everyone else, seeing what the outcome is going to be.
Yep. Yeah. I love that.
That's yeah. Such super fun.
A great example. But, you know, one of the things that I think, you know, you pointed out there that is really important is reminding. And then it's almost like having something that they go back to where it's like, oh, yes, this is what I do. You know, this is like going through those wickets. This is what I do. You, especially during that last moment, it's like you're almost reinforcing in practice. This is how I'd handle this moment, this kick, this fatigue, whatever have you. This is my tactic and strategy. And you almost want it to be automatic, so it's something they can just go back to.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And not think about, right? Where the thinking is essentially not on, oh, what am I doing? It's like, you know, like F it, let's go, and then do the thing. You know? And I think I remember talking to a brilliant sprint coach, Vince Anderson, about this. Again, great, great sprint coach. And I watched his presentation actually at Gain a number of years ago. And afterwards I talked to him, and he was talking about wickets and then patterning in the 400 and 200 for the last part of the race. Because it's like, especially in the 400, we have to pattern for the fatigue. What are they going to do? How are they going to cope with it? What does it look like? And then I asked him, I was like, do you think that applies to the 800 and 1500 and like distance races? And he's absolutely. He was like, I would train this at the end of workouts. You know, get out if you want to use wickets, like at the end of a workout, get out while they're fatigued, get out some wickets for the last 100 or whatever it is and have them run through. So you're like patterning that, or give them a different cue. Like if your cue is like, increase your turnover or increase your arm stroke, whatever it is for that athlete, pattern it in a moderately fatigued state. So it's like, oh, this is what I go to. This is what I go to. This is biomechanically what I do. So it's just ingrained in you. And I thought, you know, that was brilliant. And I did that with several of my athletes, especially 800 meter runners.
Yeah. It's really important. I'm glad you brought it up. Cause yeah, like I did that with the high school kids this year. So our patterning was actually in, speed workout. So it's our pure speed workout, right? So what it would be is a simple workout framing, and the workout was always the same. We never changed the framing of the workout. It was just a simple cut down 200, 150, 150, right? Simple sprint cut down ladder. But the way we would frame it is you're going to run, you know, of the 200, you're going to run the first 100 at 1500 meter effort and then come off the turn. Then that next 50, that middle 50 is going to be at 800 meter effort. And the final 50 is 400 meter effort. And then you do 150. Okay. First 50 at 15, next 50 at 8, final 50 at all out sprint 4. Like that. And then the 100. Okay. 800, then 400. Right. So they always knew contextually, like, all right, as I come off the turn, as I come here, there's this, you know, automatic gear shift that happens. And even as they fatigued, right, we're always working on running faster in a fatigue state, especially with a sprint workout like that. But we're not just saying, okay, run the 200 all out and just go. run the 150 all out and just go and hold on. There's concrete landmarks there. So yes, when you are in that difficult crucible and high stress environment, that is the end when fatigue is building, it does need just to be automatic. Like that's just what we do. Like we practice this every week for, you know, weeks on end. And it just became a thing everyone did, even sometimes without realizing it. And it was great to see, because that type of, automation is really important to have and ingrain, so that athletes have the tools and capabilities in the moment and they don't have to overthink it. They know their path to take, and it's instant, and boom, they can go execute.
Exactly. It's like, what are we going to do? How do we do this? And I think, okay, what is it? We've talked a lot of, okay, we need to pattern this stuff. The other thing that I think, again, is you can practice this in training, and we've talked about this a little bit on this podcast, but I think it's worth going back to it, is that I would often put our better runners maybe in a more fatigued state and then sticking them with slower runners. Or like, so one of the things that I love tactically to do is, for example, you know, let's say we're doing a, I don't know, 8x800, and we're cutting down each one. And the last one for, let's say someone like Brian is at 2 minutes or so, you know, it's pretty fast, low 2 minutes. What I would often do is I would take that next tier down, and maybe they would do 6. Then they get to sit out 2. So with the rest periods, they're getting like, I don't know, 7 minutes rest or something. And then I just go like, hey guys, I want you to blast this one. Try and put Brian in the hurt locker. And he's getting like 90 seconds rest or whatever, alpha number 7. So he's pain train. But then you'd have 3, 4, 5 guys who could now run with them and potentially drop him because they had like 7 minutes rest. Well, now you're putting Brian in a situation, and I would start him again. I'd start the other guys right in front. Now you're putting him in a situation where he has to deal with, hey, these guys might not be as good as me, but like now, because of the fatigue, they're my equals. And I have to like tactically navigate this and get comfortable sitting in big packs and being okay. I would do this all the time, or a lot of times with the women I coached, where I would stick them in the better women, I would stick them in guys' packs and be like, you know, here's a pack of 10 guys. They're running, you know, this pace for whatever this interval, like get in there. And again, it allows you to get your better athletes in a position to understand, okay, what do I do? The other thing that I like doing is, okay, if you don't like that one, with, again, some of my better runners. So if Brian is ending with a mile, for example, and he's running, I don't know, 425 or somewhere in the 420s, it's mile repeats, we're ending. What I would often do is, again, have our secondary guys, maybe 5 or 6 of them, and I'd tell them, hey, I'd go whisper around, and I'd be like, hey, you're gonna do 1200 of this, or you're gonna do 800, and you're gonna do 1000 or 900 or whatever, and no one would know what the other person had.
Nice.
So, you know, if someone's got 800, you're gonna start seeing that guy kind of pick it up and like push towards the finish, but you didn't know if he was stopping at 800, 900, 700, whatever it is. And I love that, because it would force Brian, because I'd give him the instruction. I'd be like, hey, like, you got to stay with these guys. Like, don't just pace it yourself. Think of it as like surges in a race, and you have to make the decision. Like, how close do I come to this guy? Do I follow this, you know, immediately, or do I gradually follow it, or what have you? And yeah, it was a little convoluted, but it often put people in a position where it's like, okay, now I have to think and make decisions in practice, instead of, oh, I'm just going to run 425 and pace it evenly and not worry about it, because like, this is what I'm supposed to do. And we again, get that decision making where you're training that and learning your environment and almost saying like, oh, is this person surging because they can hold it and I have to cover it, or is this person like gonna come back to us? And that's difficult.
Yeah, that's really a, you know, good example, Steven. pretty novel. Like I love it. And, you know, it comes back to exactly that. Competitiveness, coaching competitiveness is coaching decision-making and creating situations for decision-making on the fly to happen in uncertain environments. And that's the whole concept of fast losers is if we, you know, are lulled to sleep by the certainty of these setups, the certainty of the rabbit's going to go at this pace and this pace and this pace, the certainty of these types of time trial situations, there's little to no decision-making happening. You just have to be physically prepped and emotionally aroused to then know, okay, we got to get on with the pace and we're going to run this pace for however long, you know, over and over and over again. And that's where we're seeing the, you know, the rocky road that, you know, athletes, if they're not exposed to a lot of that instantaneous competitive decision-making, are going through growing pains in real time. I mean, it happened with Alan Webb, right? Like, you know, he went to Michigan that year. He didn't even win an NCAA title, you know, and then he came out and it was kind of a rocky go for him the first couple of years as a pro. He had all this promise, you know, and he eventually made really good on it. But it was still kind of tough for Alan to compete in championship races, right? He never really, beyond the U.S. level, attained quote-unquote Olympic glory or world championship, you know, ability, because it's really, really tough. And he was so much better so early on that he could kind of coast through and just, you know, or muscle his way through better fitness at the high school level than, you know, other competitors. And that's why sometimes it's important, again, to put them out of context and have them run, like, you know, I had the opportunity for, like, the high school kids, had them all run open fours, right? Or had the more open, you know, or have them run, you know, if they're a primary 3K runner, have them run 800s as well. Because you can't, to a certain degree, you can't also replicate that discomfort and pain in practice that you can in a race, right? So you can't say, oh, we're going to mimic exactly what's going to happen, because there just isn't the competitive arousal that comes with getting to a start line, having the gun go off, and having it be official. So it's important to put them in context that they might not be studs at. Like, I remember it was like, hey, I want you to face the best 400 meter runner in the conference, you know, and see what you got. And you're a 15.8 kid, right? But it took them out of that and humbled them a little bit. And we unfortunately missed this, right? You used to see some pros before this whole time trial era became like the thing do off events, right? In the build up to US AAs or, you know, what have you. Oh, I'm going to, why are they running the 800? They're a 1500 meter or 800 meter, or excuse me, they're a 5K runner or a 10K runner. Well, because this gives them a whole different context to practice competing. And that has a lot of value. And I think sometimes we forget that because now people don't want to, you know, go do something that puts them out of their context and then will, you know, result in a quote unquote bad mark or a mark that's not super fast that they can't just like, oh, look at me. I ran really fast in my, you know, primary event. It's like, no, put them out of context, because if you're coaching competitiveness, that's a really good way to give them key learning that they might not get in their primary event where the focal point is just running fast.
Exactly. I love that too. And I would do the same thing as, again, I remember sticking Brian in 1500s and an 800 every once in a while. I'd stick other guys, you know, sometimes actually I love doing this at the conference championship when, you know, everybody gets thrown in the 5K.
Yeah.
Or the 3K indoors. Yeah. It's the last event before the 4x4. Uh-huh. So I would have, you know, as long as they were healthy and stuff, like I remember, and they weren't overcooked or whatever. I remember having, you know, some of my better women or men 1500 runners, like throw in the 3K, and they weren't going to score, but it's like, get used to tactics in a conference championship that is a little bit different, a little bit weird. Same thing, actually, a couple times we stuck 800 guys who weren't going to run the 4x4 in the 5K, and they weren't going to finish. But I tell them, you know, hey, I want you to go a mile and a half with maybe one of our 5K guys, you know, our secondary 5K guys. And I'd be like, go mile half, run next to him, get used to being in the pack and just feel it, you know? And the idea was, again, put them in an uncomfortable situation. And then, you know, get used to it. Figure out how are we going to feel comfortable and at ease while I'm in this weird spot. And often, again, for some of these middle distance runners, the 5K slows it down enough and they know, or the 3K, and they know maybe they're not finishing, but it gives them the space to kind of notice stuff. And I'd tell them that. I'd be like, hey, just kind of like notice the what's going on. And I'd be like, your job is to help, you know, Johnny or Susie, who's next to you, maybe notice some of these things tactically that you know, they're in the crucible of racing, but they might not pick out. And I always felt like it was a great learning opportunity if we could do that.
And even the debrief after that is really important too. You know, if that is your design as a coach to put people out of context to build competitive capacity, then it's, you have to refrain from, you know, giving instruction or telling them what to do in the middle of the race, and just be a really astute observer and see what they are doing and go, okay, what decisions are they making? That's interesting they did that. That's interesting they did that. This is interesting they didn't do that. And then come to them afterwards and tell me about the decisions. Tell me about how that race went. Because what you're trying to do from a teaching standpoint is unpack where are their learning gaps or, fogs. And then say, okay, well, I noticed you did this. Tell me about that. I noticed you did that. Tell me about that. Because what you ideally want to do is shore up as best you can those learning gaps or competitive decision-making gaps in the regular season, so that when you get to the championship season, it's non-liability. Because that's really the thing that holds a lot of athletes back in pure racing situations is the cognitive liabilities that were able to manifest or not throughout the season. And as a coach, we can't just be like, oh, they'll figure it out without any kind of interaction. We really have to be, I think, in my opinion, sensitive to the teaching opportunity, but also the debriefing, the dialoguing, I mean, the journaling, the discovery process, and how we can help as coaches guide and facilitate that so they can find their true competitive self, their true competitive north. And everyone has it in them. And for some people, it's way harder to unpack than others. I've been there. But it's just figuring out, like, well, that's part of our job, I think, as coaches, is to help people get more competitive. Yes, there's a fitness component, a condition component, of course. But emotionally, psychologically, relationally, and from an energy standpoint, that is an essential ingredient to success in racing, is how are we building our competitive capacity?
Exactly. 100%. I think if this podcast is about anything, it is that. It's how do we build that competitive capacity? And I think you need to, yes, the time trials are great. The fast times, you know, in a lot of ways are necessary. Of course, you have to qualify for the first rounds of nationals, for NCAAs. You got to qualify for the state championships, often depending on the state from time, although Texas is not. So Texas breeds racing. But you know, world championship, you got to get the standard, whatever have you, but realizing that you also have to do things that build that capacity to compete. And the last thing that I will say on how do you build this, that is very important, that often is neglected, but if you can do relay races, you can often do this, because it takes away that idea of, oh, I have to run this time. And I'm not talking about everyone goes to Notre Dame and tries to run the championship or, you know, qualify for nationals. I'm talking go to Penn relays, Drake relays, Texas relays, like line your 4x8, DMR, 4x mile, whatever up. And often that puts athletes in positions where it's like, okay, I don't know my splits. I don't know what I'm running. I don't know what I'm doing. I just got to compete and learn how to compete in this environment. So relays are a phenomenal place to, again, kind of shift things and get things trained up.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because it's interesting too where relays are placed traditionally in the calendar and the typical competitive calendar here in the U.S. Like we had when I was in high school and still going to this day, you know, Portland City Relays, right? And that's over 100-year-old relay meet. And it happens right in the middle of the season. Penn Relays typically right in the middle of the season. You know, Drake Relays right in the middle of the season. Why are all these relay meets out there? Well, part of it is, you know, exactly this, giving people an opportunity to decontextualize their competitive capacity in a radically different setting where now it's just about being a part of a team and not necessarily like being time obsessed. We have unfortunately made relays time obsessed, but it's like, no, the point is it was set up this way from a natural progression of competitive capacity building by the old school coaches who understood this is the game we're playing. Cause like in the beginning of the meet or year, you have like the early invites where the athletes are figuring out their newfound fitness through all their, you know, off season training or preseason training, what have you. And then it goes into, okay, the relay meets. And then after the relay meets is the big invites where you get the prerequisite qualifying mark. And that's the thing. These fast times are just the prereqs. They're not the thing. And that's what we got to remember. And then you get to the championship round where now you're blending the ingredients from, all right, the fitness, the contextualization and decontextualization of competitiveness and relays, fast meets, what have you. And now we got rounds and so on and so forth. It's actually a brilliantly set up calendar when you really think about what we are teaching, can have the opportunity to teach athletes. But by becoming so time obsessed and outcome obsessed and focusing on the prerequisite so much, sometimes we forget, like, great, you got the prereq, but now you actually get to the meet and what you're going to do with it, what you're going to do now that you're here. And then people are like, oh, I'm just going to go run fast and it'll take care of itself. Well, everyone here is fast. Everyone met the prereq. Everyone had the standard. They don't just let anyone in. This isn't a show up meet. This is a, you got to like qualify meet. So that's again, the fun part of coaching to me is coaching the competitive capacity. And I think it's something that's so under, discussed that more of these conversations, you know, need to be having because it is all of us has been there where we had a really fit athlete who had a really great regular season, smashed PRs, set records, looked like they're on fire. And then they get to the championship meets and they wilt. And again, no knock on any coach and athlete we've, you know, specifically referenced here because the game's really hard, but you know, they're just more famous examples or more known examples of people who have gone through or are going right through right now through this cycle and these hardships and this rocky road. But it is an opportunity to elevate versus an opportunity to like get out there and say, oh, they went home devastated or they bombed. And that's not the case at all because the game's really, really tough and you got to respect the difficulty of what's going on, whether it's at the state level, the collegiate, regional, conference, national level, the U.S. level, or even the global level.
Yeah, I think that's what it gets to is it's not to put anyone down. It's just really freaking tough.
Yes.
So like you better do yourself a favor and psychologically and physically and mentally, all that stuff, prepare for the crucible that is racing to compete and not just racing to run fast times. So we'll leave it there. Thanks, everybody. Again, if you haven't yet, check out my new book, Do Hard Things, which will actually help with how to compete in terms of the psychology and mental framework to keep your mind steady. And then if you want to dive deep on these topics, which we cover as well in the Scholar Program in the Clubhouse, the Scholar Clubhouse, we've gone deep and we'll go deep on racing tactics and how to compete. And
that's where, yeah, that's a place where these discussions are happening in real time. Yes. It's awesome. And a lot of different perspectives from a lot of different coaches at a lot of different levels, a lot of different experience. And they are robust, insightful discussions. And the community gets stronger every time we get a member added. So don't hesitate. Join now. It is one of the best ways to level up your coaching craft and your ability as a coach and also explore different and new charted territories that you might not know which direction to take or how to even get started or weren't even aware of. It's phenomenal.
That's right. All right. Well, take care, everybody. Until next time.